Completely Conspicuous, episode 443, October 25th, 2016. Welcome back to Completely Conspicuous. I'm your host, Jay Kumar. This week it's part one of my conversation with guest Brian Salvatore as we look back at the best rock of 1985. As always, please send any comments, questions, or overwrought campaign ads to j.kumar@gmail.com. Also, please check out Completely Conspicuous at comconcast.blogspot.com and on Facebook, and you can follow me on Twitter at coomdog. You can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. And now on to my conversation with Brian Salvatore. All right, I'm joined by Brian Salvatore, one of our semi-regular trips down memory lane as we look at a year in rock. And how's it going, Brian?
Going pretty well, Jay. Let's go Blue Jays.
Yes, let's go Blue Jays. We're recording this the day before Game 1 of the ALCS, Blue Jays and Indians. Very exciting for me, very stressful time. Especially since I'm going to be seeing the great band Sloan play in concert while the game's going on. I'll be checking my phone every probably minute. But
during the Mets wildcard game last week, I had tickets to the press screening of the new Shin Godzilla, the new Godzilla movie from Japan. And it was great, but it's subtitled, and I missed a ton of stuff because I was looking at my phone to get the Mets score during it. So, oops.
Yeah, oh well. But I'm very distracted by the Blue Jays right now. But we are going to be talking today about the year 1985, which was a special year for me. And I know I always say that, but like this really was because it was the year I graduated from high school. And it's unbelievably, it was 31 years ago, which is insane. So I was 17 going on 18 that year. How old were you?
I was three.
Yeah. I kind of knew the answer to that. But
yeah, sorry, bud.
Yeah. You know, we've gone over this ground.
We have. This is old territory for us at this point. Yeah.
Literally old territory. But, you know, what, I guess, you know, obviously you've, you know, with all these kind of, especially the 80s years, you know, you've gone back, you know, it's certainly, I've gone back because there's certainly things I wasn't listening to then that I listen to all the time now. What were you, how did you kind of get into this stuff? Was it more just, you know, as you were learning about rock, you kind of, you know, picked up on these things?
Yeah, you know, it's, there's definitely, this is the first year, I think, when maybe 86 is, but around this time is when I started being aware of music, you know, in a way beyond just, you know, what I heard at home. Like, I remember there were certain songs from that year that I have very distinct childhood memories of listening to. I don't know if I listened to it in 85, you know, but I certainly, those songs remind me of my childhood for whatever reason. So, but it's interesting when we'll get to my, you know, the full list later, but there's a ton of records that I love that there's no way I could have been aware of them in 85, even if I was probably 10 years older.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just you know, a lot. This is sort of, the mid-80s were a great time to be into, I guess it was then called college rock or indie rock or whatever.
Yeah.
Just, you know, some great bands emerging and, you know, there's a ton of great stuff. But yeah, certainly not the stuff that was being played in the Salvatore household at the time. I'm always interested to talk to you about these years because, you know, obviously your tastes have changed considerably since you were 17. So how much of this stuff do you remember? You know, how much of this stuff that's on your top five or your bubbling under do you remember, like, you know, contemporaneously to that time?
I would say three of my top five albums I was listening to at the time.
Okay, wow.
And certainly, you know, I mean, I was listening to FM rock radio, a lot of AOR kind of stuff, you know, a lot of metal, a lot of hard rock, but also a lot of, you know, stuff like Don Henley, you know, like Boys of Summer was, you know, like one of the biggest songs that year, you know, and obviously came out the previous fall, but, you know, definitely in tune with what, you know, and also just pop music because of MTV and you know, I knew, you know, certainly was knew what Madonna was doing and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I definitely had a, you know, a good idea of the top 40 and sort of what was going on in general in rock. But you know, certainly as far as the college stuff, I mean, REM was starting to get played on the rock stations around here in Boston. And you know, so I was starting to pick up on bands like that. I mean, certainly not any of the SST bands or anything like that, but you know, yeah, the sort of college rock, The Cult was, you know, getting played on the radio and, you know, showing up on you know, in videos and stuff like that. And U2 was a big band then. You know, not as big as they got, but you know, around here especially, you know, with War and then the Unforgettable Fire and then with the live EP. I mean, they just they were getting, you know, Boston loved them because they were Irish, but also, you know, they were really good. So
Have you, I don't know if we talked about this or not, have you dug into the You Talking U2 to Me podcast?
oh man, you know, I've been meaning to because a couple of guys I work with who are like way younger than you, well, maybe a few years younger than you, but like they were just like going on, like, you know, and obviously I like the guys who do it,
Yeah, you would love it.
Scott Aukerman and is it
Adam
Adam
Scott,
Scott?
yeah.
Yeah, those guys are hilarious. So yeah, it sounds like they were just like these guys are at work were just like going on about all the in jokes. So I'm like, oh yeah, I gotta check it out, but I haven't yet.
As somebody who, like, I like U2, I don't love U2, but I like U2, I found myself appreciating some stuff about U2 I never really considered before, which is, like, a really nice side effect, and I laugh my ass off. I still, like, in my mind, reference whenever people say certain things, I jump to the in-jokes instantly, so
Yeah.
it's definitely worth checking out.
And they had U2 on at some point,
The
right?
last episode, they have
Yeah.
U2 on, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have to check it out. It's
Yeah.
just it sounds like, you know, I so that's a band. I mean, that was my favorite band from I'd say, I don't know, 87 to probably 90, 91.
Yeah,
So
then you have to check out this podcast.
yeah, I think I would enjoy it, so I will. So let's talk about sort of some things going on in 1985. I think the biggest thing that jumps out at me is it was kind of the year that rock became very charitable. A lot of big charity events.
We are the world.
We Are the World, Live Aid, that summer was, you know, obviously huge. Farm Aid kicked off that year with, you know, Neil Young and Willie Nelson and all those dudes. And then later in the year was Artists Against Apartheid with Ain't Gonna Play Sun City, which actually, you know, Little Steven kind of, you know, got behind that. But, you know, there were some big names involved in that. Bono and you know, Keith Richards was on that. You know, there's a lot of, you know, artists. And that was a hot button issue because, you know, it was all about South Africa, you know, which at the time was still, you know, had apartheid going on, and you know, the black residents of South Africa were basically just being kept down, and but artists would, you know, there were a lot of boycotts going on of South African businesses, and I think there was actually a big thing around here because Shell gas stations, they had a huge investment in South Africa, and I remember one of the DJs on the local big rock station at WBCN had a sort of a Shell boycott thing going, and I remember he had Roger Clemens involved in it, you know, because it was just, you know, he was a big celebrity, and you know, and apparently, you know, he was
Before he went crazy from the
before,
roids.
yeah, so you know, it was interesting, but yeah, it was, you know, just a lot. I mean, obviously, you know, it was the thing to do. And then, you know, not too long after was Hearing Aid, which was the heavy metal, you know, basically, it was basically the heavy metal We Are the World.
Yep.
You know, it just, there was all sorts of crazy. There was a Canadian one called Northern Lights, which had like Anne Murray, Geddy Lee, like Bryan Adams, like basically anybody from Canada.
Triumph.
Triumph was probably on it, but yeah.
I don't know.
They probably were. But yeah, it was just like, you know, I think it was a time where, you know, rock stars needed to feel good about themselves while they were doing all the hookers and blow. So
exactly,
this was kind of like a way to do that. Like, you know, all right, I'll sing a couple of lines on this stupid song and, you know, feel a little better as I, you know, snort the shit out of my nasal cavities. But what are some other things that that you noticed about '85?
Well, you know, it's amazing to me how strong the sort of undercurrent of college rock was, because if you look at the Billboard charts, there's no influence of that whatsoever.
Oh no.
Yeah, this is still like, you know, hair metal, bubblegum pop, you know, up and down. Yeah, there's still, you know, there's still some residual effects of like Purple Rain and Born in the USA and a lot of big albums like that. But for the most part, it's a year that I'm not. Like, there are certain years when I look at the pop charts, I'm like, oh, this is full of great pop songs. Songs that maybe aren't my particular, you know, that I'm not playing around the house all the time, but are like, sure, really solid things. This year isn't so much that to me. I think this was not the strongest year for pop music. There's a lot of, it seems like there was a lot of 70s acts having big hits this year. You mentioned before, Don Henley, you know, Boys of Summer. You get Glenn Frey with The Heat Is On.
Ugh, God.
You get some Sting, you know, some of the first real solo Sting success. You, you know, just, it's, this is like the, when I think of 85, you know, Live Aid is obviously the first thing that comes to my mind, but also, I just think like the height of MTV. At this point, MTV was in a lot more households than it was the first couple years. It hadn't quite changed into something new yet. It was still mainly videos and live shows. And, you know, you just think of sort of that golden age of MTV. And, you know, I guess the music kind of reflects that. There's a lot of style over substance in the pop music at the time.
Yeah, and this was actually the year that I got MTV for the first time in my house in Kingston, New Hampshire, which is a pretty small town. We had cable, but we didn't have MTV on the cable system until I went to college in the fall of 85. And when I came home for Christmas, we had MTV.
Were you calling your local cable provider and saying you want your MTV?
I was not, actually, but I used to go, you know, I had a buddy who lived in the next town over. I'd go to his house 'cause they had it. So like, I'd be watching it, you know, we'd sit there and just watch, you know, I remember one time going over his house. We watched The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai.
Nice.
And then watched just rock videos for like 4 hours, you know. And, you know, you'd see stuff like, and MTV at the time was so all over the place because you'd see, you know, Madonna and Michael Jackson and, you know, Hall & Oates. And then you'd see Rush, Distant Early Warning. You know, it's like, whoa.
They had 24 hours to kill.
Yeah. Springsteen, Stevie Ray Vaughan, like, you know, it was just all over the place. So, but yeah, I always think of like, you know, it was sort of peak 80s though. I mean, I know you're talking about like sort of 70s acts, you know, Kool & the Gang was, you know, a lot of solo acts. I think we had talked about this with another 80s year where it was kind of like the time where a lot of artists went solo. So, you know, Phil Collins was huge with No Jacket Required. That was a monster album that year. But, you know, you've got like, actually, this was the year that what I think is the worst song of all time was released, which is We Built This City by Starship.
Did you read the oral history that was found? Oh, it was
so good, man.
Yeah.
That was so good. It came out like, I think, about a month ago, and it was hilarious. But, you know, lots of soundtracks still. So, like, yeah, that Glenn Frey song was on the Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack, which, you know, I love that movie, especially that year. You know, it was like, you know, Eddie Murphy was like the hottest thing in Hollywood. And, but that soundtrack was god awful. But yeah, like, you know, Stevie Wonder was, you know, had a big hit with Part-Time Lover.
Mm-hmm.
Wham was huge. Wham had the number one song with Careless Whisper.
Cue the saxophone.
And actually, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go was number three in the year end. And then, you know, they had like, I think, three songs in the top 30. So they were big. But yeah, it was a lot of kind of, you know, Duran Duran was huge then. You know, View to a Kill. Actually, that was the James Bond movie.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
But, you know, Jack Wagner was on the charts with all my... he was a guy on...
General Hospital, right?
General Hospital, yeah. Later Melrose Place. You know, it was a weird, the Pointer Sisters, Neutron Dance. I mean, it's just like Robert Plant had a huge hit with Sea of Love and the Honey Drippers. I mean, that was like basically like a 50, they were doing 50s covers.
Yeah.
And he, in the band, he had like Jeff Beck, I think Paige played on a couple of songs. You know, I think Bill Wyman was on that out. Like, it was just like, you know, all stars, but playing like basically the songs they played, you know, when they were teenagers. Prince followed up Purple Rain with Around the World. Was it Around the World?
No, it wasn't Around the Day.
Around the Day. But Raspberry Beret was really like the only big hit off it, but it was, I mean, that's just an amazing song.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, you know, a lot of weird songs. One Night in Bangkok, I don't know if you remember that.
Yep.
It's just like a strange, strange song from Chess, right? Wasn't that what
I believe was? So, yes.
Which is like by the dudes who did Jesus Christ Superstar, yeah. Right?
I don't know if this came out in 84 or beginning of 85, but I know a big hit that year was Chicago's You're the Inspiration.
Oh, yeah.
I think that was 84, but like bled over into 85.
There was a lot of stuff that came out in 84 that ended up on the charts in 85 just because it was so big. Like Henley, mm-hmm. Like, you know, a lot of that shit. I'm looking at something. Aretha Franklin, "Freeway of Love." You know, there was a lot of weird. It was very diverse, but it was all pop on the singles chart.
Yeah.
David Lee Roth had released you know, "Crazy from the Heat," so he had a little hit with California Girls.
Uh-huh.
And then
is that
later,
the record he also released in Spanish, or is that the next one?
No, it was "Eat 'Em and Smile."
"Eat 'Em and Smile," yeah.
Yeah. "Sunrise Salvaje." Which, you know, I probably should have bought. But, and then the top albums, you know, the number one album is Born in the USA, which came out the year before. Reckless by Bryan Adams, number two, that came out the year before. I think Like a Virgin came out in 84.
Believe so.
So, like, you know, Private Dancer by Tina Turner. So a lot of stuff came out the previous year. Purple Rain is number nine. But, yeah, you know, then you have like Survivor was number 15 with Vital Signs. Could name one song off of that album, you know?
No.
Yeah. It's, you know, Unforgettable Fire, number 19. Foreigner was deep into their ballad phase with I Wanna Know What Love Is. That was like a huge song. That came out the year before. So there was a lot of that stuff. You know, Dire Straits was huge in 85. With Brothers in Arms, of, you know, obviously, they had that video for Money for Nothing was just, you know, and it was like, it's funny, you watch it now, it's like the cheapest.
It's the worst animation you could imagine.
Computer animation, but like at the time, it was like, oh, this is so cool, you know, it's like, and, you know, and I kind of liked it because, like, I like the riff, but, you know, and Sting singing the hook, but, you know, now it's just like, but that was like the biggest thing around. I remember going to college in the fall, and like everybody was still like all over Dire Straits, which is funny to think about now. I actually like the first few Dire Straits albums, especially the first one.
Yeah, I have no problem with the Dire Straits.
Yeah, but they kind of got after that they didn't really do much. But I think they just this album was so big for them. I mean, I think they got a couple of years out of this, and then I don't think they really knew what to do after that. I think they maybe had one more album, but it didn't do much. Whitney Houston had a huge album. I think it came out. I want to say that came out in 85. But you know, she was obviously, you know, she. I think her next album was even bigger. Like when she really went poppy, because the first album was kind of more R&B ballads, and then she kind of went into more of the pop thing, you know, like, was it I Want to Dance with Somebody was like, yep, the big song, you know. But and everything was on MTV, so that's really what drove a lot of this. But then, you know, we were talking about sort of the rock stuff, the hard rock stuff. Dokken at number 35 with Tooth and Nail. Now, I had that album. That was a that was, you know, I think that was an 84 album too, actually. But, you know, Triumph was in the top 100. You know, it's just like, yeah, like, you know, it's just a weird. Deep Purple's, they reunited sort of their classic lineup in fall of 84, Perfect Strangers, which is actually a really good album. That's on the top 100. You know, Night Ranger. So it was just, Van Halen's 1984 was still finished in the top 100 in 85 because it had so many singles. Rat, Invasion of Your Privacy, you know, it's just like these albums that just, you know, nobody gives any thought to now. And actually, that actually finished higher on the charts than Mick Jagger's solo album, She's the Boss, which was a total bust. So yeah, it was a weird time for music. But yeah, like you said, you know, sort of the college rock thing was happening. You know, it wasn't necessarily selling a lot at the time, but, you know, bands like REM were starting to get played on rock stations.
But there was no influence of that, though. Like, you know, I remember, like, in the late 90s when there was, like, the whole, the beginning of the techno, like, thing, you would hear bits of that pop up in, like, every corner of music, right? Like, metal bands started having a DJ in there, and pop music had that. There was no REM influence on any mainstream record. You know, it's odd that way.
Not at that time, but, you know, a few years later,
right?
You know, by like 87 or so, you know, when REM, you know, the Document came out, and then all of a sudden you started to hear more things get on, like the Smithereens, you know, bands, you know, more jangly kind of, you know, stuff, more earnest, you know, rock. You know, bands like Driving and Crying were getting record deals. So, you know, it was, you know, it happened, but it was slow. It took a while. I mean, obviously, you know, bands like Husker Du and Black Flag and the Minutemen and, you know, all those SST bands, you know, they were percolating, you know, sort of underneath everything. But, you know, you weren't hearing a lot of bands. There were a ton of bands that sounded like them, but they weren't on the charts. You know?
Exactly.
We weren't hearing them, but they were out there. So yeah, like some other things that happened that year, VH1 launched right at the beginning of the year.
Really? Was that early?
Yeah, because it was at the time, it was basically like, you know, videos for older people. It was kind of like, that was the demo. It was going for like the, you know, the moms and dads of the kids who were watching MTV, you know.
And that demo lasted until, geez, what was it, like 2000 maybe?
Yeah, until they started doing, like, you know, sort of the reality shows.
And yeah.
Then, you know, like, they started doing, like, Rock of Love and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden it was, you know, it became, like, a reality show, just like MTV did. But,
yeah.
But, like, at the time, you know, it was more like adult alternative kind of stuff. You know, a lot of Bonnie Raitt, a lot of stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
It was weird. And it was all videos then. But, you know, like, I remember, like, I don't think I watched VH1 probably for, like, yeah, a long time after it launched. But, yeah, it was kind of a curious thing. And now it's, you know, now they basically, I don't even know what the hell they do with it now. I think it's still just, like, all these kind of, it's sort of like the MTV version of, like, Real Housewives. Like, it's kind of like, you know, dating shows and stuff like that. But, another interesting thing in 85, the PMRC hearings started. That was
yes.
The group started by Tipper Gore, Al Gore's wife, the Parents Music Resource Center, which is basically, you know, these, I think it was like, I don't know, it was all congressional wives, but it was folks who were concerned about, you know, the lyrics, the content in music. You know, they think they really focused on heavy metal primarily at the time.
Even though it was started because of Darling Nikki.
Yeah.
That was supposedly the song that kicked it all off.
Yeah, that's right. You know, masturbating with a magazine.
Uh-huh.
But the target really became, you know, because metal was starting to kind of catch on, especially with, you know, teenage boys and you know, obviously there the hearings, you know, you had some infamous appearances by, you know, Dee Snider, actually Frank Zappa.
Frank Zappa, Dee Snider, and John Denver.
Yeah, John Denver. Because, you know, that guy's music was just obscene.
Supposedly, but, he was like the staunchest guy, though. Like, he was really, you know, he didn't want his music censored at all. And the rumor was that Rocky Mountain High had been censored on a lot of stations because they presumed it was about drugs, and it wasn't. And you know, so that was where his skin was in the game.
And then, ironically, he died because he was flying a plane while drunk.
Yes, so. Exactly.
But yeah, that I just remember that. Obviously, that actually led to warning labels
on
albums, which ended up being the greatest thing for albums, for metal and rap albums. Because
it boosted sales considerably. Yeah,
kids saw that and they were like, oh, this must be cool. I'm going to buy that. So, you know, it ended up being pretty good for business. But yeah, you know, it was something good too, I think, for bands to rebel against. You know, it was kind of like it gave, you know, it gave a face to the, you know, to the enemy, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like these bands could kind of, you know, their audience, you know, in their jean jackets, drawing their logos on their folders at school. You know, they kind of had something to to root against or to rebel against.
Yeah.
It ended up totally backfiring and for, you know, what it was supposed to do. But it was funny that they were had, you know, these actual Senate hearings where people were like reading the lyrics of like, you know, King Diamond albums and stuff. So
now do you know, cause I don't buy a lot of music via like iTunes or something like that. Does iTunes still show those labels? I presume they do, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I know there's a little red explicit tag that pops up, but I don't know if there's still, like, on the album art, if there's still any indicator of that.
That's a good question. I'm still kind of looking at my, I have my iTunes open, but I don't know if they necessarily, they might. I think if it was, like, I don't know, because it was kind of a sticker, so it wasn't necessarily, you know, but I mean,
eventually it became part of the album art, though.
Yeah, I suppose.
Like on the actual, like you would remove the booklet from the jewel case and it'll be on the booklet, you know?
Yeah. Maybe they do. I don't know for the older ones. I mean, and then there were cases where like, you know, you had Jane's Addiction where, you know, their album, you know, Ritual du Habitual, the original cover was like a painting of, Perry Farrell, like in a, I don't know, with two naked women, and he's naked too. And they ended up, because they wouldn't get it carried in stores, they ended up doing kind of a First Amendment cover where it was just like a white cover.
Yep.
With like the sticker and then the
Bill of Rights on it, right?
Yeah, the Bill of Rights. So there, you know, obviously there, you know, there were some cases where, you know, you couldn't get that stuff through, but I don't know. You know, I think it more than anything, it just kind of, it was just sort of like a guide to like, all right, here's the stuff that mom doesn't want me to listen to, you know? So I'm going to listen to it. I mean, you know, I just remember like stuff. It was more like for me with like comedy albums that I had to sneak in. Like,
yeah.
You know, Eddie Murphy's Comedian. I got that on cassette so I could, I was buying everything on vinyl, but I got that on cassette because I didn't want my mom to hear it, because if she did, she would have lost her mind.
Right.
So, you know, that was on the Walkman, but, you know,
that's funny. Else... I did the exact same thing. I bought comedy albums on cassette for years.
Oh yeah.
For that reason.
Yeah, if she heard like one word of that friggin' album, I would have been like grounded for a year. So, yeah, that was, but yeah, I mean, you know, as far as like, you know, metal bands, I had my door closed anyways. I'd be cranking that shit in my room, but, you know, I wasn't necessarily worried about that stuff. But yeah, PMRC definitely was, you know, added, you know, it just gave us all something to kind of complain about, I guess. But, another, big event, because we love to talk about Van Halen, David Lee Roth. Van Halen in 1985, although, you know, now he kind of says he was, you know, he was pushed, but he wanted to stay. But once he started working on the, you know, he did the Crazy from the Heat EP and then got a movie deal from CBS and was kind of working on that with, you know, with his, with Pete Angelus, his kind of his partner, his business partner. And, you know, I think Eddie kind of, you know, things were bad, I think, for a couple albums anyways, between, Dave and Eddie, and that kind of just was the final straw. And Eddie was just like, you know, all right, you know, and so there are different stories, you know, where like, they'll, one side says that Dave left on his own, and Dave will say, well, you know, I wanted to stay, but they wanted me to go. So who knows? It's, you know, they're all back together now, sort of, but although maybe not really. Who knows?
Somewhere Michael Anthony is shedding a tear of you saying they're all back together.
Yeah. Well, actually, I don't think they are all back together. So it's, you know, it's a big question mark as to what's going to happen with that band anymore. But because there's always rumors that Dave's going to get the Eat 'Em and Smile Band back together. So who knows? But
I think that would probably be a more interesting live show at this point.
Absolutely. Well, and, you know, they almost played a show and then it got canceled because there were too many people at the club they were at.
So oh, really? I didn't hear about that.
Oh, yeah. I want to say it was, what was it, last summer? Yeah, they were supposed to play the, it was at this, there's this bike bowling alley that's like a rock club in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's pretty small. And, Dave basically showed up to play with the, with, you know, Vi Sheehan and, Greg Bissonette. And they were all set to do it. The fire marshal literally came out as they were on stage and was like, yeah, you guys can't do this. Cause there was like so many, there were like people, you know, the word got out and basically it got canceled before it even happened. But then there's like, you know, all these rumors that, you know, he's willing to do it. Oh, cause it was the 30th anniversary of Eat 'Em and Smile.
Right.
So it must've been right around in July, I think actually. And yeah, so there, you know, there's talk like, you know, is his contract with Van Halen up? Can he do it? You know, so who knows? But yeah, I guess really they were going to do, the band was going to play Eat 'Em and Smile album with Sarah Steel Panther, who is actually his own Van Halen cover band and, you know, basically played David Lee Roth. But then Roth showed up and it worked out and the place just got, you know, mobbed. But the rumor is that they're going to actually do it, all willing to do it, supposedly. It's all up to Dave. So.
Wow.
That would be cool if they did that, but who knows? Stay tuned for your latest Van Halen drama. Meanwhile, just Eddie, I don't know, he's just counting his money somewhere. But
I love, like, that guy fascinates me. Reading Eddie? About that guy, oh yeah. Just he's so bizarre.
Well, it's like, and we talk about this like every time we,
I know.
We talk about, like, he hasn't really released any new music since like the Van Sharone album.
Yeah.
You know, Van Halen 3, which we infamously dissected a couple of years ago. And that came out in 98. They did. They recorded a couple of songs with Dave in 2000 that never got released. And then I think they might have recorded something with Sammy.
They did. They recorded a couple of songs with Sammy for our Greatest Hits record.
Greatest Hits. But other than that, like, he hasn't, I mean, you think about like all the new music he lives in a studio. You know, he's got to be recording shit like literally all the time, but he won't release it because I think he was so burned by the critical, you know, the negativity towards that Van Halen 3 album that he just won't release anything anymore. Because that Different Kind of Truth album with Dave was all old demos. That was all shit that they
right,
did
yeah.
literally in the 70s that they just kind of, you know, kind of polished up and Dave put some new lyrics on or whatever.
And supposedly Wolfgang picked all those songs that he listened back to all the demos and he picked the songs.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But like, so Eddie claims he hasn't bought an album since
right.
Peter Gabriel's So.
Right, which came out 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, just strange, strange man. You know, and supposedly clean and sober, like, you know, he was a mess for a while there, and now seems to have turned himself around. I know he got remarried to a woman who's now who was his publicist, who I think kind of keeps a tight rein on, you know, what gets out about him, obviously. Right. But trying to, and then like for them to release that live album, you know, like
that was so terrible.
That was so bad. Like, and they had done like good shows. What, you know, since Roth had been with them, like, you know, I think the first tour, like I have a bootleg from like 07 or 08 from that first reunion tour. That's really good. And like, you would think they must have recordings of every show. Like, why would they pick like this, a shitty show in Japan? And then they put it out and it's got like the worst possible art. Like, you remember that? They had like a...
I'll take exception with that. Really? The last Black Flag album had the worst possible art.
Oh, that was bad. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that, I don't even call that a Black Flag
album. Well, yeah.
but that thing with the boat, I don't know, it was just like, it was just so, yeah, it was bad. I mean, I don't know what the hell he's thinking. Like, they literally, what he should do is, and I know that there's tapes of like, you know, like the Fair Warning tour when they were just at their peak. You get one of those shows, you put out a DVD, you put out an album, you'd sell a zillion of them, you know what I mean?
Yep.
It's just like, I don't understand. Like, you could put a whole series of archival shows from, you know, from the early days, and, you know, and do it from the Sammy years, do it from now. You could put out, you know, they would have to pay
Michael Anthony for that stuff.
Yeah, I guess, but they'd still make money, so much money. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's probably an issue. I think he doesn't want to acknowledge those days. But like, that was such a big part of the band.
Well, that's the paradox here, right? He's afraid to release anything because it won't live up to those days. Yet anything from those days, he will only take credit. He'll take sole credit for.
Right.
Like, maybe he'll give Alex some credit too. You know, but it wasn't about Dave. It wasn't about Mike. It's just, you know, I don't know. I think there's a great Van Halen book to be written one day when all that dirt comes out.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I'll be, you know, I mean, have you read Dave's book?
No, but I've heard it's fascinating.
It's very entertaining. I bought it last year, and I also, you know, I had gotten the book Van Halen Rising, which I have pimped many times on this show.
Right. Yeah.
My friend Greg Renoff, who
wrote, just sitting on my shelf waiting to be read.
Oh, you got to read it too. It's really good. But like, it's about, you know, sort of how they got started and the first, I think the first tour, maybe the first two tours, but I think actually just the first tour, but like, it's, I mean, there's so much good stuff about sort of the early days. It's fascinating, but I'd love to see a book, you know, kind of for the mid period when they really started to hate each other, because that's, you know, that's that's just like, I mean, you know, you already kind of hear some of these stories about just how they, you know, were just, you know, started just drifting apart and getting really ridiculous. But but yeah, I mean, you know, I'm sure like if the dirt ever, you know, if Eddie ever actually like opened up to somebody or, you know, did a book himself, if he was honest, it would be a good book.
Now that Roth book, like how often was your bullshit alarm going off when you're reading
it? Oh, it's all bullshit. I mean, it's just like, I mean, it's just, it's insane. It's written by a madman. It's, you know, it's just, it's, you know, just imagine Dave talking, you know, you know, stream of consciousness. I mean, that's like literally, I think he talked into like a tape recorder and they printed it, but it's fascinating. I mean, you know, it's just, it's all over the place. And it's him kind of talking about the ill-fated movie thing, which was interesting, but then, you know, then talking about doing these like, you know, safari trips in the jungle and then talking about like his philosophy about, you know, stakes. I don't know. Like it's all over the place. It's just like, the inner workings of a lunatic, but it's fascinating. I really enjoyed it.
I, you know, if I wasn't trying to be a well-rounded person, I could just read rock star biographies all day long.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure like some are better than others, but you know, I mean, I read Neil Young's book, not the one about his, about the car, but like the one that came out before that, like a couple years ago.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, literally like he just kind of, you know, he talks about like, you know, Pono for like, you know, he keeps bringing up like, oh, you know, it holds, you know, MP3s only like, you know, contain like 20% of the music and, you know, 20% of the, you know, the, and he just like goes on and on, you know, like he just, you know, he'll talk about his, you know, he'll talk about his cars and, you know, how he's like trying to like, come up with a, you know, a car that can run on, I don't know,
farts, something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
there's a,
it gives, it's just like his book is just kind of, you know, it's like right when he gets to the good stuff, it ends.
Yeah. I don't think it's been released yet, but there's a podcast I like called Rock Solid. It's a spinoff of Never Not Funny. And they did something really cool for a live show. They got four people, and they each read the same story out of the four Kiss biographies, autobiographies. Oh. So, like, you know, the recording of Destroyer, but they had somebody read it in, you know, they had a Paul Stanley read it, a Gene Simmons read it, etc. And just to compare how different their takes on all that stuff was. And it's a pretty great idea.
Yeah.
Because those guys are pretty full of shit, too.
Oh, sure.
You are listening to Completely Conspicuous with Jay Kumar.
That wraps up episode 443 of Completely Conspicuous. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you join me next time when Brian Salvatore and I continue our discussion about the best music of the year 1985. In the meantime, check out BFF.fm every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 Pacific, to hear my radio show Stuck in the Garage. Check out Mixcloud.com/CoomDoc to listen to archive shows. Jay Breitling produced the opening and closing themes of this show. Voiceover work is courtesy of James Grillion. Completely Conspicuous is a Tan God production.